that is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. And since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
So you just heard from Nick. Man, the forecast for Puget Sound for the next few days is typical January weather, mostly cold rain, very dark. But that wasn't the case 139 years ago this week when the big snow of 1880 paralyzed the Seattle area, which is why historian Felix Bunnell is here for his Wednesday visit, brought to you by the King County Library System. How bad was it?
Well, it was pretty bad, but the records are kind of scant because this was 139 years ago, and there's no official weather data from Seattle for those years. And actually, Jeff Renner had just started his internship in the King 5 First Alert Weather Center. So, and the first Weather Bureau office didn't open here until 1893. But there's some pretty decent anecdotal information. And that great local historian and photographer, Paul Dorpat, he of those wonderful Seattle Now and Then columns and his blog and all kinds of great books. He first wrote about the big snow of 1880 nearly 40 years ago. I talked to Paul earlier this week. He told me how it started to snow on the first Sunday of the new year, and then it didn't really let up.
It came down for about a week from the 4th of January. Started piling up and crashing through roofs and knocking over sheds with its weight and basically making a mess of things.
So the city was pretty much shut down. Transportation was difficult. Schools were closed, and the heavy wet snow made some wooden buildings collapse. Now, the actual snowfall total is a matter of some speculation, but there's no doubt that it was a massive amount that came down that week. Arthur Denny is one of the earliest European settlers and considered one of the founders of Seattle. He wrote a reminiscence of pioneer days that was published in 1888, so this is just a few years after the big snow. And what he said, quote, "The deepest snow ever known here was in January 1880, measuring 4.5 feet after it had settled, and would have measured much more as it fell. I made inquiry of the Indians and could get no account of anything like it before, and it may therefore safely be called unusual, as the like has not been known to the white inhabitants except in this instance." So it's a huge amount. Another historian named William Prosser estimated 5 feet of snow even after it had been compressed. Another historian, Clarence Bagley, said maybe 7 feet fell. And more recently, a researcher named Wolf Reed estimated a total of 6 feet. Whatever the precise amount, it's safe to say that it was probably the most snow ever on the ground in Seattle. Fortunately, there's a handful of photos from the big snow, and Paul Dorpat shared those, and we've posted those at My Northwest. But I want to step back from the weather part of the story, because 1880 was a pivotal year for Seattle. It was the start of the decade of the most rapid growth in the city's history, by far, before or since. I asked Paul what living in Seattle was like for the average person back in 1880.
Well, it was the largest town. You had a certain amount of pride. That year, the census revealed that it was the largest town in the territory. Walla Walla had been the largest town before that. And so you were living now in the town that had the most citizens, and it never gave that up.
And the population of Seattle grew from about 3,500 in 1880 to more than 42,000 by 1890. That's an annual growth rate of more than 28%, which is just off the charts. Walla Walla, by comparison, also had about 3,500 in 1880, and by 1890 had 4,700. Not to pick on Walla Walla, but even way back in that pivotal year of 1880, Paul Dorpat says that Seattle wasn't actually too different from now in terms of infrastructure.
It still didn't have any mass transit. I mean, it didn't even have a common carrier. It didn't get that until 1884 when there was a horse trolley that was built that went up Second Avenue up to Cell Town. It did have sewers. It had running water. It had a telephone. And electricity was going to become commonplace pretty quickly. So it had a lot of the things, actually, that you and I now take sort of for granted.
So because there wasn't a lot of especially transportation infrastructure to paralyze, I asked Paul if maybe the big snow of 1880 was actually not really a hardship, maybe a nuisance at worst, or maybe even just kind of fun?
That's it. That's it. And a good thing to make jokes about and to remember and actually to enjoy. It was to the greater good of the citizens that they had all that snow drop on it. They enjoyed it. They had a good time.
Just like now, right? Now,
right.
You know, there were sleigh rides and snowball fights and young men making money shoveling snow. Speaking of snow removal, Orange Jacobs was the mayor of Seattle in January 1880. The city council appropriated $100 for snow removal. I couldn't find anywhere if the administration gave themselves a letter grade for the snow removal.
Yeah.
Is it too soon for a joke like that? Sorry. Apologies to Greg Nichols. Also in the middle of this, there was this huge windstorm called the Storm King, which hit the Willamette Valley and part of Southwest Washington, blew through Seattle, didn't do any wind here, but brought more snow around January 8th. And it's weather geeks call this a Storm King. It's not as well known because it's so long ago and the records are sketchy. But, you know, all this stuff comes from Paul Dorpat's wonderful book. He's got a new book out now about the top 100 photos of his Now and Then column. So it's just really crazy that this storm has never really been, no, it's never come close before or since. This huge amount, like 6 feet of snow over a week. It's crazy.
Find the contractor who only charged $100 to clear the streets.
Yeah, and who knows how many plows they had in those days. But anyway, it was a great storm.
Thank you, Felix. Nope. All of Felix's stuff is on MyNorthwest.com. He joins us every Wednesday for a look at the non-breaking news affecting Seattle. And
I have one more thing I wanted to share. Let me hand this book to you. Hang on.
Yes.
I was down at Powell's in Portland the other day. I'm always looking ways to make more powerful radio, and I saw this book called Creating Powerful Radio.
Creating Powerful Radio, yes.
I had actually already bought it and was walking back to the train station when I thumbed through it, and I saw a very familiar face leap out at me at page 98.
Page 98, there I am.
And it says, hybrid news talkers like Dave Ross are rare talents. Wearing both hats, they manage to bridge the gap. A listener can tell what Dave thinks from his newscast, but also knows what an objective and conscientious newsman he is when hearing his talk show.
How about that?
It is impossible to describe Dave Ross's creativity, but we can all attest to that, I think.
Yeah. Well, buy this book right away.
do you remember being part of that book?
Or? Yes, I was interviewed by Valerie Geller, yes.
Okay, maybe we'll put this on social media, the picture of you from, I think the book's from 1996. That's a picture of you from probably 1980.
That was my lobby shot from the old Cairo building. I was looking very authoritative and remarkably young.
That's nice. People know you've been creating powerful radio for a long time, Dave, so thank you.
Well, thank you. You're so nice, Felix. Do you realize Washington State was one of the pioneers of paid family leave? We passed a law back in 2007. We just never funded it, so it never took effect. But now it's been funded, and it is taking effect. That's going to mean some changes, and Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott is here to tell us how this changes for, we're going to talk about employees?
Employees this time around. I'll be back to tell you later about employers. So, yeah, this all kicked in starting yesterday. The funding mechanism of this, as you mentioned, it's been a long time coming, been in the works for more than a decade, but never had a way to pay for it. That changed last year when the legislature passed new legislation that will see both employees and employers start paying into the system this year. The benefits will be available next year. Kate Tiley-Hurst is a lawyer at Seattle's Davis Wright's Tremaine, where they've been working for months now to help businesses get ready for this new law.
What this is it provides partial wage reimbursement for individuals who have their own serious health condition or have a family health condition and need to take some time off.
It allows for 12 to up to 18 weeks, depending on the situation, and of paid time off. Tiley-Hurst says it's like an insurance program similar to unemployment benefit. But under paid leave, both the employees and employers pay the premiums.
What the calculation is it's 0.4 gross wages. Then that 0.4 is divided between employees and employers. And so I think the easiest way to think about it for those employees out there is for somebody who makes $50,000 a year, you will have approximately $2.42 taken out per week of your paycheck. So that will be the employee portion, and then employers will pay a portion as well.
And the split for most cases works out to 63% from the worker, 37% from the business. Now, businesses with fewer than 50 employees will not have to pay into this program, but workers don't have to make up the difference there and can still access the full benefit. And that benefit for workers is a pretty big deal, with Washington's paid leave program among the most generous in the nation of the roughly half dozen states that even have such a program.
What it provides as far as the wage reimbursement is that it's a maximum of up to $1,000 a week with a minimum at $100 a week. So it's a partial wage reimbursement, caps at $1,000 a week, and it's based on how much an individual makes. And so that gets into another complicated formula as far as how you determine what an individual will get under the program, but it's significant. It's a significant benefit for individuals without having to pay a large portion into it.
Every worker in the state will now start paying into the system right now, with a few exceptions.
If somebody's a self-employed individual, if they work for the federal government, or if an employee is covered by a collective bargaining agreement that's been in place since October 2017, there's some limited exceptions there as far as when the deductions will start coming out. For an independent contractor, you have the option to pay into the program. You can elect to be part of it, but it would not be mandatory for those individuals.
Self-employed workers and independent contractors choosing to opt in would have to pay both the employer and the employee portion, and they'd have to work 820 hours in four quarters, the same requirement that regular workers need to meet in order to qualify for the benefit. Now, the cool thing about those hours?
So let's say somebody works two part-time jobs in Washington. They work, 20 hours for each employer per week. What's great about this program is you're going to count all of those hours towards your qualifying total hours to be able to access this benefit. So essentially, if you work 820 hours for any amount of employers in Washington, you get to that 820, you are able to access that benefit. It doesn't matter if you have four different jobs.
And she says the other important thing to remember about the benefits are?
I've seen some misunderstandings as far as who can access this leave, and it's not limited to people taking parental leave. It's intended to take care of you as individuals when you have serious health conditions, as well as allowing you the opportunity to care for family members when they have serious health conditions.
And next year, when you're able to get this benefit, what is going to be considered a qualifying event?
I'm going to be able to access that leave for my own serious health condition. And then qualifying family leave events would be caring for a family member with a serious health condition, bonding in the first 12 months of adoption, birth, or fostering a child that's under 18. The definition of family member is also quite broad. It would cover children, parents, spouses, siblings, grandparents, and grandchildren.
So again, when you starting next year, you'll be able to have that benefit. Everybody's starting to pay in right now this year. It started yesterday for anyone with your first paycheck. Average $50,000. If you earn $50,000 a year, you're going to pay about $2.50 a week, and then your benefit would be next year you'd get about $800. It's a little under $800 for that.
So even though I'm covered by a company plan already, I could take 18 weeks off to bond with my grandchild.
You could no. So 18. It depends. You can take up to 12 weeks for that kind of leave or to be with a grandchild. And then the 18 weeks, that extra 2 weeks that comes from that would only apply for a woman who has complications in pregnancy that would allow for
that. They'd have like a doctor's note for that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you have to for some of these, you'll have to have doctor's notes anyway or some sort of medical.
But in my case, all I have to do is prove I have a grandchild.
I do believe so.
Which would be pretty easy because I got all the pictures in my smartphone.
Yeah, but I think you'd have to be the parent in order to have the paid family. Absolutely. So I want to be clear though. So in order to just hang out with your grandkid, you'd have to be the parent to get that kind of leave off to bond. But if there was some, if the grandchild was ill, then you would be able to, as the grandfather, be able to care for him.
Right. Thank you, Hannah. This is Seattle's Morning News. The Centers for Disease Control is out with a new report showing the highest number of U.S. gun deaths in 40 years. Of course, it's already getting pushback from gun rights people who point out that most of these deaths are suicides and gun control laws are not going to change that. Let's talk with Dr. Joseph Sacrin, who is Director of Emergency General Surgery at the Johns Hopkins Hospital. And you were a gunshot victim yourself, is that correct? Tell me about that.
Yeah, that's correct. At the age of 17, I was nearly killed after being shot in the throat with a .38 caliber bullet. That event really inspired me to go into medicine, inspired me to become a trauma surgeon, and then really, you know, figure out how do you work at that intersection of medicine, public health, and public policy.
Yeah, and so you have been campaigning for stricter gun control laws, but answer this criticism that most of them, and we're talking about something like 40,000 gun deaths a year in this new survey, but most are suicides, and the gun rights people are saying, well, you know, that's terrible, but people are going to do that whether or not they have access to guns.
It is absolutely true that the majority of gun deaths, about two-thirds, are from suicides. And suicides are violent acts against yourself. And so we consider these to be part of the overall problem that we're facing as a country, when we talk about this public health crisis. Our goal is to reduce firearm-related injury and death in America and make communities safer.
So then how would you carry that out without enacting some form of gun control that the NRA would, you know, obviously lobby against very hard?
Well, I think the first thing that we must recognize is that when you talk to Americans all across this country, what you will find out is that we actually have a lot more in common than we have that divides us. And I've spoken to hundreds, if not thousands, of gun owners. And when I talk to them, we actually agree on most things. And so I mention this point because, and it's an important one, because the disparity that exists is not between gun owners and non-gun owners. It's actually, I think, between the leadership of the gun lobby and everyone else. When you talk to responsible gun owners, they actually want a lot of these different implementations and common sense solutions we're talking about.
Well, give me some examples of some things that the rank and file want, but the leadership lobbies against.
Yeah, so one example would be expanding background checks. We know that currently 1 in 5 guns are sold without a background check. And that results in thousands of firearms that are falling through the hands of people that shouldn't have them, like felons and domestic abusers. Closing those loopholes is something that seems very straightforward and anyone would want. The second example would be to really ensure that we have federal dollars attributed to being able to study firearm injury and death in this country. As you know, we've had essentially a 20-year ban on really being able to look at gun violence research.
Well, federal funding for it. I mean, private organizations have been doing research, haven't they?
Yeah, but you know, even private organizations until recently actually haven't been investing dollars that are proportional to the burden of disease. We have, you are correct in the sense that we have seen a number of organizations like the Laura and John Arnold Foundation that have, you know, committed $50 million towards gun violence research. We've seen TOMS recently, you know, Blake Mikowski came out with a $5 million pledge. So we're starting to see these, you know, private-public partnerships and people trying to really figure out how do we become innovative about coming up with the data so we can appropriately apply solutions to this problem.
Now, beyond the suicides, to homicides and violent crimes, what do you propose for that? Because we already have laws that say if you've got a record, you can't have a gun. And obviously, it's illegal to shoot somebody unless it's in self-defense. So what else would you do in that area?
First, when we look at some of these laws that are starting to pass, known as the ERPO laws, Extreme Risk Protection Order, which essentially allows family members and law enforcement to seek court permission to temporarily remove guns from a person in danger of harming themselves or others. Now, some of these laws have been implemented, but I think to your point, it's not just about passing these laws, which I think this is a great piece of legislation, but it's also about ensuring that people know about it and about enforcing and implementing it. And I think California, what happened in Thousand Oaks is a great example, where my understanding is that law, even though it stands in the books, was not implemented with that perpetrator. Mm-hmm. So being able to not only have common sense legislation like ERPO, but ensure that people are aware of it, they understand it, and that it's enforced, I think that entire spectrum is going to be very important.
So creating a culture where people in the medical profession report somebody who shouldn't be owning a firearm.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's just the medical community. I think as citizens, we have both, you know, the possibility and the responsibility to watch out for each other, to ensure, you know, the safety of one another. Only working together are we going to be able to really move this needle forward. And I think part of it starts with having the right conversation and using the right language and making people understand that this is not about taking away firearms. This is about responsible gun ownership. And we think that you can do that, you know, while respecting the freedom and responsibility mm-hmm. that as Americans we have and want.
That's Dr. Joseph Sacrin, Director of Emergency General Surgery at the Johns Hopkins Hospital. Dr. Sacrin, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your time.
Time for your Daily Dose of Kindness now. It's a program that brings a special kind of love and encouragement to classrooms that need it. CBS's Jan Crawford reports from a Washington, D.C. school where grandparents are part of the lesson plan.
As the day begins at XL Public School in Southeast Washington, there are a few mature faces among the young girls rushing to class. Wearing blue aprons and serving up hugs are six foster grandmothers.
You make me with the caboose.
Working alongside the school's teachers to help students succeed. Principal Tanaya Pritchard said she'd love a grandparent in every classroom.
Our grandmothers live in the community, so they see our young ladies at the grocery store, on the buses. And so the girls, when they're at home and in their communities and with their families, they can see a part of school.
For Grandmas Dixon, Wanda Brookings, and Maureen Brooks, the word that best describes their experience is joy.
But it's a joy to get up every morning knowing that a smile and a hug is waiting for me. Who wouldn't want to get up and get that?
And they need you.
And they need me, and I need them each and every day.
Do you feel like you're really helping yes. them learn?
Yes. You see it every day. Little things I do with my children in the room. I have one little girl.
You wink.
And then I say, Then that lets her know, you're doing good today. Mm-hmm. And I
just
love
that encouragement, like a wink and a mm-hmm. thumbs up.
That's our secret.
The program is only open to seniors earning less than twice the federal poverty level. Nationwide, the Corporation for National Community Service helps more than 150,000 young people work with 22,000 foster grandparents in nearly every state. Cheryl Christmas runs the DC program, one of the largest in the country.
We try to match individuals in areas and in schools and early childhood that people are struggling. The kids benefit from the social-emotional connection. And then for the grandparents, they too are learning.
For these grandmothers, the program's most valuable benefit is in the classroom.
Love. Don't cost anything. Mm-hmm.
I had one little girl to tell me. She said, do you know how much I love you?
Mm-hmm.
You know how you turn your eyes because you have tears mm-hmm. in here? I said, you just don't know how much I love you today, baby. Mm-hmm.
But you're getting emotional about this.
You see, so many children, they don't get love. They have no idea what love is about. Mm-hmm. And to me, to share my love, that can take them a long ways.
That is CBS's Jen Crawford reporting.
Very sweet. It's time for the 2019 edition of our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is, having almost completely recovered from the Rose Bowl, 710 ESPN's Danny O'Neill. Here's my question. What does it take for a Husky team to be like, say, an Alabama team? What's the difference?
Well, right now the difference is the strength on the line on both sides. And I think that what we've seen is that when they go up against top 10 programs, like Penn State was last year, like Ohio State is currently, like Alabama was when they played them in the Peach Bowl a couple years ago, heck, even to a degree like Auburn was in the season opener this year, I think that Washington has a hard time being able to run the ball. And they also tend to give up some pass pressure. I think that's the biggest thing. And that the possibility that we saw the best of Jake Browning, and that he kind of reached a plateau in his final 2 years at the program. He's a great, great college quarterback, and he led this team to an awful lot of success. But my answer for why Washington hasn't really been able to get over the hump here is the strength on both sides of the line.
Now, we discussed earlier in the season that the teams, to a certain extent, choose their opponents. Does Washington have a habit of choosing too many easy opponents?
They did, and I think that that's absolutely been a problem, Dave, is that Steve Sarkisian, in the second half of his tenure as Huskies coach, dialed back the difficulty of the schedule. And typically Washington has scheduled, they've gone with a Category A, where they'll play a top-tier sort of heritage school like Michigan or Ohio State or LSU or Nebraska, one game against kind of a mid-level team from one of the bigger conferences, not a perennial power by any stretch, but a team that's from a bigger school, and then a cupcake. And they went to a program where they were eating a couple cupcakes and maybe a Twinkie in there in non-conference, and that's terrible for you, Dave. That's no way to start a new year with a resolution.
So many additives and GMO stuff in those things, yeah. Let me ask you this. There are schools which seem to put football first before anything else. Is that our problem? We put other things before football, and that's why we can't get no respect?
You know, no, I don't think that's true. I think geography has a large part to do with it. The Pac-12 doesn't do itself any favors. It has bad distribution of its TV network. That does not help the way that they've arranged it.
Does not help what? You mean recruiting? I mean, because a lot of this is baked in once you decide who to recruit, isn't it?
Yes, but the biggest difference in recruiting is geography.
Yeah.
I mean, why is Alabama so good? It's in the heartland of one of the top recruiting spots in the country, with right next to Louisiana, right next to Florida, and they've got a great recruiter there. So I won't go so far as to say, hey, you know what, the TV network has undermined everything. It hasn't helped them. I don't think it's how much we care about football, though. I guess you could go to the extent and say, because college coaches don't make as much in the Pac-12 as they do in the SEC, and that conference just throws more money at it, there have certainly been times that before Alabama had this current run, what's the best program that we saw get on a roll? It was Pete Carroll at USC. So mm-hmm. I don't think there's any sort of, there's nothing preventing a Pac-12 team from rising up and having a really dominant run.
That's good to know. Okay, so who on this Husky team goes on to greatness?
Well, I think you're going to see two players, both of whom will have college eligibility left, who I expect to leave. And they've said that they haven't reached that decision. But Byron Murphy, who's a cornerback, I think he's, if he decides to come out, he's played two seasons here, but he's been on campus for 3 years. He's eligible to enter the draft if he chooses. I think he'll be chosen in the first half of the first round. And Taylor Rapp, a safety who didn't play yesterday because of a hip injury, which was a real bummer. I think he'd be a first round pick if he comes out. We'll see if they end up entering the draft. Speaking as just a fan and somebody who's watched them, they've both been incredible players. I also think Ben Burke-Irvin, number 25, the linebacker, he may or may not get drafted. He's certainly undersized for that position, but he's going to play on Sundays. He is a heck of a player.
Yeah, and chances for next year? Any prospects on the horizon that would signal
a quarterback? A kid named Jake Eason, who came from Lake Stevens. He went to Georgia. He's got 1 year of eligibility. He's been on campus for this year. Yeah, I think there is going to be a lot of hope, and we're gonna see what this team looks like with a different quarterback. Jake Browning was by almost every measurement, set the most records of any quarterback in school history. But there was the feeling, and I saw it. I thought he kind of plateaued his past couple years. We'll see if Eason can take him to that next level.
The new paid leave law. A law actually was passed years ago, but finally it's being funded, and that means that workers here in Washington State are going to see a new deduction on their paycheck as we roll out the state's new paid family medical leave system. Last hour we talked about what the program means for employees. You'll be able to hear that on Seattle Morning News podcast after the show. And Kyra's Hannah Scott is here with what employers need to know for their side of the bargain.
So, Dave, as you said, Washington was a leader on paid leave when it became the first state in the nation to pass it back in 2007. They never found a way to fund it. They figured that out last year, and now we're seeing that funding portion start to take effect. It works like this. Employers and employees both have to contribute. Now, a worker earning 50 grand would see close to $2.50 a week taken out of their check. And then when benefits kick in next year, you'd be eligible for about $780 a week for up to 12 to 18 weeks, depending on your circumstances. Workers earning more than $50,000 would get a larger benefit that caps out at $1,000 a week. Employers also have to pay a smaller amount into the system. In most cases, the breakdown is like this. Say a person's check is $2,500. The total contribution combined from employer and employee is about $10. The worker would pay about $6.30 of that. The employer would pay $3.70. Kate Tiley-Hers is a lawyer in Seattle who's been working on this issue for months to help businesses get ready for this new law.
Let's get ready for 2019. What does that mean? It means we need to let our employees know this is going to happen so they're not caught off guard, and have that communication to say, this is a deduction that's coming out. This is a state program. This is what it's going to look like and what you will be able to access starting in 2020. And the second piece is, start taking those deductions, and that's happening now.
And employers, she says, also need to make sure that they're deducting the employee's portion.
January 1st, deductions need to start, and then there's quarterly reporting requirements to ESD, to the Employment Security Department, and that will include specific information about your employees in Washington as far as who they are, how many hours they've worked, how much they're making, so that ESD can track that benefit.
Now, with some companies in the state already offering some type of paid leave, she says employers also need to take a close look at their existing policies to see how they're going to work with this state plan.
There is the opportunity to do what's called a voluntary plan, where an employer can say, we are going to administer this ourselves. We are going to have our own plan, provide the same benefit, but we'll take care of it ourselves. There's some pretty unique reporting requirements on that, but it's a good thing for employers to keep in the back of their mind before 2020, before employees can start taking this leave, to make sure that they're providing the benefit that they want to be providing.
So if an employer does want to take that route,
they can apply for a voluntary plan. They still have reporting requirements. The state still needs to know who their employees are and how many hours they're working, how much they're making. But they can apply for a voluntary plan, and once that's approved, they are not required to remit premiums from employees or submit anything to the state, as long as they're providing as generous, if not more generous, of a benefit than what the state law requires.
There are also some exemptions for smaller employers.
If you work for a small employer, which the law tells us is 50 or fewer employees in Washington state, that employer does not pay the deduction. It doesn't mean that those employees are going to pay a larger portion. It means that that portion of the employer deduction will not be provided to the state.
So to be clear on that, if you've got 50 or fewer employers or employees, the employer will not have to pay into that system. The employee still would, but it wouldn't mean that that employee would pay a higher amount. They're still going to pay the same amount. Tylee Hurd says the entire thing is still in the rulemaking phase, so it's a little bit fluid. We have to have the funding into effect this year in order to get the benefits to start coming in next year. But she admits there's still some cost concerns.
Is this program adequately funded? And is there going to be enough in the pot to account for individuals taking leave? What will be the usage rate of this? And that's a real unknown right now. There is some language in the law that there can be an increase in the premium amount. So we could see an increase to 0.6% growth. And it's unclear after that point, if it's still underfunded, what's going to happen? Are we going to see those premiums increase? And I think it's probably likely that we will see an increase in the premium amount.
Yeah, because if an employee is contributing $500 a year and then takes 18 weeks the year after, there's no way that's paid for by him. So,
well, and again, the real unknown is how many people are going to take advantage of this.
And how often do you get to take the 18 weeks?
How often?
Is that each year you could take 18 weeks?
Every year. Yeah, it's an annual thing. And again, the 18 weeks is a high number. That's only when we're talking about a woman in has a complication in a pregnancy.
Yeah.
For the most part, we're talking about between 12 and 16 weeks. You can take that multiple times, too. If it can be broken up into 2 weeks at a time.
We talk a lot about pregnancy, but this also has to, if you're hit by a car,
you're going to need to take that time. Yeah.
So it also includes catastrophic, you know, medical situations.
The legislation says serious health situation. So basically, you could break a leg, anything requiring surgery. And it's not just about pregnancy and parents. This allows for you to take care of your sick grandchild, your sick parent, your sick sibling, anything like that. There are a variety of things. Also, we talked about that it's possible that this could apply for someone who has to go for rehab, for treatment, for substance abuse, things of that nature. So that is all still being worked out in this rulemaking phase. But, you know, that would be a big help to a lot of people as well. I do want to point everybody to paidleave.wa.gov. Everyone from employers to employees can go there, find out everything you need to know. It's a page dedicated to this new role.
Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
We are into the 12th day of a partial government shutdown. In about 45 minutes, the president's going to hold one of those public cabinet meetings, and then around noon, he's going to gather Republicans and Democratic leaders in the Situation Room to decide what to do. Let's go live to Washington, D.C. Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Farenthold. I saw some pictures of garbage piling up on the mall. Are they indeed letting garbage just pile up on the mall, David?
And not just there. The National Park Service is basically not working now. So there's garbage piling up on the mall. They're not picking up the garbage. We had this great story today from the Joshua Tree National Park in California, where apparently the Trump administration has chosen to open the parks, but not really to staff them. So people are wandering around in there for free, but also basically pooping in the woods and wherever they can go because the bathrooms are all locked. So it sounds a bit like chaos in those places.
Well, that's the way it used to be back in the old days. So what about the last time was a government shutdown. Of course, the big issue was the war memorials and, you know, veterans groups visiting only to be told, no, you can't visit. So I assume they're keeping all the monuments open. It's just that they're, what, piled with trash now, or how does that work?
Yeah, I mean, the monuments, I think before they actually, under Obama, they had actually closed off the monuments. Now, I think everything, you can go visit it. You just, you know, the Smithsonian's are closed. Anything with a door is locked. But things like the monuments that are outdoors, you can walk up to.
And how much money is this saving us?
It's really not really saving us anything. We're going to have to pay back any of these. The employees that are off now will probably be paid back later. I don't think there's really any savings. And there'll be some expense accompanying clearing out all the crap, clearing out all the garbage, getting everything back to normal. So I don't see this as a savings.
All right. Well, if you visit D.C. or a national park, bring your own wastebasket. So let's talk about the op-ed that appeared in your newspaper written by the newly minted senator from Utah, Mitt Romney, who first of all said the president doesn't have the character he should have. And then he writes this. He says, I do not intend to comment on every tweet or fault, but I will speak out against significant statements or actions that are divisive, racist, sexist, anti-immigrant, dishonest, or destructive to democratic institutions, which means he's probably going to have to comment on every tweet.
On every tweet.
So what was the thinking, as far as you know, behind this op-ed that Romney wrote?
Well, I think Mrs. Romney, who just got elected from Utah, obviously asserting himself as somebody who's going to not be in lockstep with Trump in the Senate. You know, he's going to be, I think, playing the same role that John McCain did or Jeff Flake did, Bob Corker did, speaking out against Trump, being a critic within the Republican Party. Now, what Romney doesn't say in that op-ed, and what we're going to have to wait and see, is does that rhetoric turn into action? You know, does he do what McCain did and vote against some things that Trump is pushing? It's hard to know right now what role Romney will play, but it's really interesting for Romney to sort of announce himself as a Trump critic kind of before he even takes office, rather than waiting for the first one of these controversies to come up.
Well, is he preparing the way to challenge him for the Republican nomination?
I mean, I see this sort of in the same way I see things that John Kasich has said, the former governor of Ohio. These are guys who wouldn't, you know, are definitely thinking about it, but then they're going to wait to see if Trump is severely weakened within their own party. Running against Trump right now within the Republican Party would be a suicide mission for any of those guys. But if there's some major event that happens in the next year that really weakens Trump, they're laying the groundwork to jump in, either to run against him or to run if he's off the stage.
Yeah. So, is there any sign that how do you tell whether the president's support is, quote, weakening or not, given that, I mean, he didn't win with a majority of the votes, but the thing is, he won in those key states, and even though his true blue supporters might be a minority, they are an intense minority, right?
That's right. And within the Republican Party, which is what Kasich or Romney would have to consider, you know, first, could they win a primary against him? I don't see a lot of evidence that Trump has lost a lot of support. I mean, he's at 90% or 80%. I mean, even if he's lost something, it's nowhere near what he would need to lose to be vulnerable in a primary challenge. I mean, the Fox News Trump feedback loop, I mean, there's a lot of people who are in that loop who get their news from Fox News, and Fox News tells them Trump is doing great, and Trump listens to Fox News and does what they want. So as long as that feedback loop is still happening, that's going to be a significant portion of the Republican Party.
Is that true, though?
It's going to be hard to challenge him.
Is that really true, that just because Fox says things are going well, that means things are going well? Because I thought one of the things that put him into office was that people were really hurting. They felt that they had no future. It's not that they were homeless or anything, but felt stymied by whatever, regulations, you know, sluggish salaries. So is there any kind of economic factor that you think Donald Trump has to be worried about here?
Well, certainly. I mean, Trump has benefited from the fact that in 2016, when the economy was actually good for most of the country, Trump ran, sort of reaching out to people who thought it was bad. And then once he took office, Trump switched his message and said that the same economy that he inherited from Obama was actually great. Trump has benefited from the continued rise of the stock market until the middle of this year, when for a variety of reasons, some of them having their origins with Trump himself, his trade war with China, things like that, the stock market has started to decline. There's a lot of signs of, you know, possibly economic slowdown here and around the world. If the economy falls off, you know, if people don't feel like Trump is creating prosperity for them, he will lose people. I think that Trump's one of his biggest allies has been the economy so far. But, you know, good economies never last forever.
Okay, but so you're saying that Trump won because he convinced people who really were not that bad off that they, in fact, were miserable. And now that he simply has redefined what their lot is, they will accept that and vote for him again?
Well, it depends on what their lot is. I mean, I think it depends on what actually happens in their lives. I mean, mostly Trump won in 2016 because he ran against Hillary Clinton, that a lot of people really, really didn't like. If he runs against somebody else, presumably in 2018, I think Trump's going to really need the economy to give him a boost to beat whoever that other person is. If the economy's not going well, it's going to be hard to make that to win if Hillary Clinton is on the ballot.
Well, but I think he's also making a calculation that even more important than the economy is the culture change thing, i.e. immigration, that he is the one who's preserving America the way you remember it. And that's why I think he focuses on that wall. Don't you think so?
Yeah, and certainly. To Trump voters, Trump's base, the wall was a really important sign. I think opinion polls overall show that the Americans are becoming more welcoming to immigration and not less in the Trump era. But the Democrats certainly need an argument beyond the wall is bad. And it will be interesting to me to see the 2020 Democratic contenders try to come up with an argument about immigration that is, you know, a positive, not just like, I don't want what Donald Trump wants, but here's what I want and it's why it's better. So far, Democrats just seem to be arguing a negative that Trump's approach is the wrong way, but they don't really articulate their own.
David Farenthold from The Washington Post. David, thanks very much.
Thank you.